Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the article by Weeks et al. Titled, Cores of Reproducibility in Physiology, Practical Tools for Improving Experimental Design and Reporting of Laboratory Studies of Cardiovascular Physiology and Metabolism. This article was published July 26, 2019. Joining me today are Deputy Editor Mary Lindsay, Lead Author Julie McMullen, and Content Expert Lisandra De Castro-Brash. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. In this study, the McMullen team, led by Dr. Kate Weeks, evaluated whether preclinical researchers from the Baker Institute could be encouraged to improve the quality of their cardiac and metabolic animal studies by incorporating strategies and protocols that would remove or reduce bias. Julie, walk us through the experimental design.
Thanks, Mary. So we first asked animal researchers to undertake a short survey so that we could acquire baseline data on how animal studies were being performed, with a real focus on the degree of blinding, randomization, and allocation concealment. From the start, we wanted to make it very clear that we wanted to obtain honest answers, not perfect answers, because we really wanted to understand what people were currently doing and to understand any barriers and challenges. This was followed by providing researchers with knowledge, tools, skills and training to see if we could improve practices. This was assessed by a follow-up survey about 12 months later. So we've provided a detailed overview of the exercise in Table 1 of our manuscript. And just as one example, we included one-hour sessions describing different types of bias, structured methods of randomization, which could be easily used, and methods for de-identifying drugs or interventions.
And what were your main reasons for undertaking this exercise?
So I had become very aware of a number of commentaries and editorials describing some concerns regarding the quality of preclinical research and the limited translation. One comment that really stuck with me was that most researchers have a disproportional number of papers with positive results than negative results. There can obviously be a number of reasons for this. One reason includes publication bias, with authors and journals not necessarily wanting to publish or spend time on negative results. Another reason can include unconscious bias, leading to researchers identifying in their data what they're hoping to see and possible false positive results. And I think this can really occur due to added pressure on researchers to succeed these days. Over the course of my career, I had also realized I had undertaken a number of studies which other labs had previously performed, but were not published because the result was negative. So a number of researchers are potentially wasting time and resources on the same studies. And then finally, I was also concerned that a number of researchers were following up on studies with suboptimal study designs, rather than focusing on results which are more likely to lead to meaningful discoveries and translation.
I like that concept. Lisandra, what were the major findings of this exercise?
Thanks, Mary. There were four major findings. First, the initial analysis showed that parameters such as pre-specified endpoints, inclusion or exclusion criteria, structured randomization, the identification of interventions, etc., were not used by most of the PIs. Second, it was clear that these types of experimental details were only reported in publications if it was specifically requested by the journal. Third, training was well received and successful. When provided with knowledge and tools, PIs not only were willing to implement changes, but also stated that this study allowed them to improve the quality and rigor of their animal studies. And finally, the study also found that resistance to change was present if involved more time and personnel.
Yeah, that was a very thorough analysis that they did. Julie, it's interesting that you saw no difference in response between the responsible investigators and the other investigator members of the team for whom the exercise was actually optional for them. What do you make of that?
To us, that really showed that researchers within a lab or a team will generally perform the studies in the same way as their lab head or PI, and highlights the importance of leadership in this area for promoting as well as driving change.
I agree with that. If you want your folks to do something a certain way, then modeling that change is definitely the best way to help them see the usefulness of doing that. Lissandra, the team focused on improving practices for randomization and blinding. Do you agree that these are two focal points to improve rigor and reproducibility?
I do, most definitely. Not only this improves reproducibility, but implementing these practices as standard operating procedures in the lab will reduce bias, leading to more accurate reports.
I agree with that. Julie, what were some of the key aspects that resulted in improvements?
There were a number of aspects which were important during this exercise. First, the engagement of Kate and I as basic researchers with clinicians on our manuscript was important because clinical studies have really led the way, for example, for pre-specifying inclusion and exclusion criteria and pre-specifying endpoints. It was also important that leaders of the Institute were not coming across as too prescriptive. From the start, I wanted to emphasise that I had never received any formal training in experimental design myself or performing structured randomisation or formally de-identifying interventions. So it was important to highlight this was not a finger-pointing exercise and that we were only looking for honest answers, as this was an opportunity for us all to improve practices. Having both Kate and Darren on the manuscript, who are both early to mid-career researchers undertaking animal research, deliver the training sessions and provide practical examples of tools was also important because I think it made it far more relatable for our junior researchers. And I'll also note that all these tools are available in the source data of our manuscript. And then finally, follow-up was also important to demonstrate that leaders of the Institute were serious about implementing change. So the director of the Baker, Professor Tom Marwick, was very supportive throughout the process. After the first survey, the director and I would visit laboratories and ask how researchers were going with the new suggested methods and any challenges they might be facing.
Julie, you mentioned in the article that efforts to pre-specify inclusion and exclusion criteria, and you use a modified version of the Consolidated Standards of Animal Experiment Reporting. There's a flow diagram that was developed by Drucker and colleagues. Were you aware that Europe is undertaking similar strategies and have encouraged data collection and analysis plans to be announced before experiments even begin? Their website is www.preclinicaltrials.eu.
Yes, we were aware of these efforts. As we mentioned in our manuscript, identifying reasons for keeping or discarding animals or data should be determined ahead of time. One area that can be tricky is to announce analysis of plans ahead of time, because often in basic research, the initial findings drive new experiments and the manuscript does not always follow the original experimental design. As we mentioned in our discussion, pre-specifying endpoints is not always possible in these cases.
I would agree with that. I think that trying to guess all of the endpoints before you start from a basic science point of view is going to be where the difficulty is. But certainly identifying why you would keep or not keep data or animals, et cetera, that's certainly something that we could, you know, say ahead of time and disclose. Lissandra, I was encouraged to see that a major conclusion of the study was that the investigators are willing to make the change when provided with knowledge and tools and solutions that are simple to implement, as you mentioned in one of your 4 points. Has this been your experience with similar attempts to increase rigor and reproducibility in your own lab?
Yes, it has. For example, you know, graduate students get, as they should, very involved with their projects. They want to do every single experiment on their own. So to avoid bias when they're analyzing their data, what I did was to set up a blinding and de-identification exercise in a lab meeting. So now we have each grad student paired with an undergrad. The undergrad will blindly prepare all slides for histology, just as an example. So when a graduate student performs their staining and their quantification, they have no idea which animal received which treatment. We do the same when we have any type of drug delivery. So overall, this has given the students peace of mind that they're not skewing their data or overanalyzing it depending on what they expect to see. All of them were very excited to participate. The protocols were very simple, therefore easy to implement. And I think that is why it has been successful.
And I like the idea of starting early when they're graduate students. You know, as Julie said, most of us who have been trained in cardiovascular research were not necessarily given this extensive of a training in experimental design. So it's nice to see that graduate students today are receiving this at a much earlier point than we did. Julie, talk to us more about the incentives and mandates that are needed to make this occur at a more systematic level. Does everything have to be punitive, or could there be some positive reinforcements that would work?
Yes, that's a great question. Overall, it was really pleasing that most researchers wanted to do the right thing and improve practices. For instance, with the structured randomization, it was relatively simple and quick, and uptake continues to improve. But for other areas, such as allocation concealment, more consideration and personnel time is required. And it was noted that this can be a little bit more challenging for the smaller labs, particularly when funding is tight. In some areas, such as stating pre-specified criteria or endpoints in publications or reporting animal exclusions in publications, there was real no notable improvement, and most people noted this was because journals did not request it. So there are some areas where I think mandates from journals and granting agencies will be required. But incentives are also really important. We have tried to emphasise that negative results should not be viewed unfavourably. In my own experience, negative results can often lead to unexpected and interesting new lines of research.
Those are all good points. I also think that this may be a good way to motivate small labs to work with other labs and come into this team science point of view. And really, team science and working as a group are the future. Lissandra. One phrase that struck me in the discussion was the phrase irreproducible research. We always talk about research with a positive spin as being reproducible and responsible, but flipping it around highlights that if efforts are not made in the one direction, by default, the research ends up in the other direction as irreproducible and thus irresponsible. What are your thoughts on this concept?
Well, Mary, this is a very interesting concept and one that, as you say, we normally do not think about or talk about enough. The fact that we are now discussing irreproducible and therefore irresponsible research is applaudable, and I want to thank AJP Heart for providing us with this platform and the CORP series. Lately, irreproducible research has been a focus of several entities, including NIH here. Unfortunately, we see reports on research misconduct that have become common and they keep showing up, and these are important to be highlighted. However, I suspect that the percentage of irresponsible research is much higher than we think, not because misconduct is in place, but because the lack of appropriate tools and knowledge, as emphasized in Julie's manuscript, leads to bias and/or incomplete reporting. It's nearly impossible for labs to truly reproduce research if they don't have the details of a previous study. And if we continue to not utilize the tools that will give us the most unbiased data that we can possibly get, even unconsciously, we are going to be producing irresponsible research.
I agree with that. Julie, I like how Table 2 gives solutions to possible challenges. In Table 3, one potential deterrent listed as to why labs may not want to randomize or blind is that effect sizes are likely to be smaller, leading to a requirement for larger animal numbers. I found this interesting. Do you think that this is an actual or more of a perceived deterrent? Is there any literature that conducting a rigorous study makes an effect size smaller? I would think decreasing the standard deviation would increase effect size.
Yes, as an example in terms of the literature, in the stroke field there have been reviews and meta-analysis of studies with the same outcome measure, such as infarct volume in response to the same experimental drug. So it was found that when studies were not randomized and not concealed, the positive impact of the drug, in this case a reduction in infarct volume, was greater. One reason that could explain this is that without allocation concealment, there could be unconscious performance bias in the care provided to animals based on the treatment. And for some studies, there are more subjective measures, such as assessment of cardiac function by echocardiography. There's also a concern that effect sizes or false positive results have increased because there is so much pressure for researchers to succeed. So when a p-value is close to being significant, it can be tempting for researchers to go back to their data to look for potential outliers. We know that sample sizes are often quite small for animal studies, sometimes less than 10. So the biased removal of outliers from groups can dramatically increase the probability of false positive results.
Oh, I see. Those are all excellent points. And I know last year in our guidelines for statistical considerations of cardiovascular research, we talked about the removal of outliers and under what conditions those would be appropriate or not. Lysandra, Table 3 also lists that a possible deterrent is that fewer positive results will be achieved. What do you think? Is this a real possibility, or is it more likely that there will be fewer false positives?
I think fewer positive results will be a consequence of fewer false positives. However, independently, this should not be a deterrent. Not so much in clinical research, but in basic and translational research, the stigma of publishing negative data is real for both the researcher and the journal. And to improve accurate, responsible reporting, we also need to change this perception that negative data is bad data.
What I'm hearing from both of you guys is that we really need to remove the stigma of publishing negative, but I also think we need to make the distinction between having some negative results in your study versus everything you did, the entire study was negative. Could you guys comment on what you think about that?
I agree with what you just said, Mary. It's going to be very difficult if you want to publish a study that resulted in 100% negative data. But as you just said, most of the time, each project will have some positive and some negative data. And we are able to combine all that data and normally have a very nice cohesive paper. I think the problem, and Julie mentioned this in the beginning of the podcast, is when it's a smaller study, maybe you wanted to check a certain direction of research and your hypothesis was completely wrong and the data is negative and people decide, okay, I'm not going to report this. It was a small project, but this means so many other labs are going to try exactly the same experiment and waste their money and their time because they don't know someone already tried it. If there was a platform that you could do like pilot studies and show the negative data, maybe this would help.
Julie, what do you think?
Yes, I agree with all of those points. I think another important point is that journals are often wanting, I'd suggest, the perfect story. And sometimes we get requests from reviewers and we're asked to do additional experiments. And we might perform 10 different additional readouts or look at 10 additional readouts. Three might sort of fit with the story and the other seven might not, so that we will present the three but not the full 10. And I think we have to get away from that as well. We really should be presenting all our data, both the positive as well as the negative.
Okay, so Julie, what's the next step from here?
So we have just completed another follow-up survey, which was 12 months after the last. And so on first glance, it's pleasing to see that there now has been further uptake with the structured methods of randomization with time. The Institute is also in the process of providing training in other areas, including the presentation of data. So where possible, we're really trying to encourage researchers to use scatter plots rather than bar graphs. And we're also looking at providing some training in statistics, because I think that's another area which has been lacking. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but I think current improvements have definitely been encouraging.
That's excellent to hear. AJP Hart has just started a pilot project where we have a group of figure reviewers who go over all R1 submissions to make sure that scatter plots instead of bar graphs are used, to make sure that molecular weights are reported for Westerns, you know, et cetera. So we're piloting that as a way to, at the review stage, make sure figures are as precise and as clear to readers as they can be. Dr. McMullen, thank you for publishing this very interesting article in AJP Heart. Dr. DeCastro-Bros, thank you for giving us your expert opinion. Back to you, Kara.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit us online at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.